From time to time, I cross paths with someone who knew me as a child but never expected to meet me as an adult. Out of common courtesy, they are usually able to conceal their surprise at seeing me out in the world until an opening, a gap in the conversation, allows them the space to articulate their initial reaction. "So, you're still alive?" My junior high ethics teacher once told a story. When her husband died, she cut off her long hair. Afterward, she sank beneath the water in her bathtub. This she experienced as a purification. She was interested in rituals, and she brought a measure of gravity to her class that I valued as an extremely grave 14-year-old. I wanted to learn as much as possible. Time, it seemed, was running out. My ethics teacher taught me the term liminal phase. It describes the most vulnerable part of a rite of passage, the point at which one finds oneself between worlds. It is the period in which a young person is no longer a child, though not yet an adult, or when the dead have abandoned the world of the living but cannot yet be counted as ancestors. During these phases, things can go drastically wrong. But they are also where transformation takes place. We come into being in these phases. Without them, the world could not go on. I progressed from junior high to high school and then on to university. And then, one day, I ran into my old teacher again at a conference. She had gone to graduate school. Her master's thesis was on Norse mythology, on the Jotuns, symbolic of the dark and treacherous aspects of human existence. I was a doctoral student in linguistics. I had begun an in-depth study of rhetoric and how reality may be altered through language. She had written a history of mentalities, about modes of thinking that we can no longer fathom. Our worlds had reconvened, in a sense. My old teacher wasn't surprised to hear that I was pursuing my doctorate. The junior high school was a 10-minute walk from the university library, where I once used my mother's card to borrow books on the shamanism of indigenous Siberian tribes. I was familiar with academia from childhood, and it showed. It shaped others' impressions of me. It promised a particular kind of future, in the same way that the opening sentence of a book points to how the story is going to unfold. She was, however, surprised at how good I looked. This was the other narrative of the future, the one that didn't have to do with my language, but with my body. This phrase makes me feel uncertain. "You look so good." "Yes, don't I? I dress nicely. I've spent time educating myself about cut, about style. I got a tailored coat when I was 18. I like coats with cuffs that can be unbuttoned, and Oxford shirts with collars that roll the right way." But that wasn't what she meant. What lies beneath, the surprise that I am still alive, surfaces only later in the conversation. Or at least this is what happened with an author I knew from high school. 10 years later, we stood together in the grand ballroom of Oslo's Hotel Bristol. With a blend of melancholy and reluctance, her eyes smiled. She remarked that it was something they all knew back then, the fact that I was not going to live for very long. Something they all knew? This wasn't something I knew. And since I certainly was not the person who had put this idea in their heads, where did it come from? The author I knew from high school couldn't say. The notion had simply existed. It was a shadow cast by nothing. The only substantial point of reference was my body. In those days, I often rode in a wheelchair, but I had also frequently crossed the schoolyard on foot. I used to go out during breaks and stand around with everyone else in a circle. We would talk about our teachers. We would talk about Ulysses, too, and joust over who had read the furthest in that book. That's the kind of school it was. I thought I was just one among many. I didn't know that I was projecting a particularly tragic aura. I did know. I didn't have the words to express it. I am trying, now, to find them. I follow a timeline that others might have followed. I live in the same city where I grew up. I am an academic, a child of academics. I live a life like theirs. I am married and have a child with Ida, who is a woman who writes. My son has my eyes, which are my mother's eyes. His face has features reminiscent of childhood photographs of his grandfather. These are the threads that hold my life together. This is the fabric. Whenever I am recognized by someone who recalls the child I once was, a rift occurs, a rupture. The image is jarred. The life I live is displaced, briefly, by a reality that never happened. It glides past like a specter, depicting opaque but familiar images, phantom images of an alternate future that followed me until I became an adult. The recognition is followed up by the same compliment. You look so good. And it is that word, so, two letters at the center of a polite phrase that carries everything within it, that which could have been, that which never was. Did you get better? No, I say, I am more or less in the same shape that I used to be in, the way I was back then. My wheelchair is the same. I sometimes walk. My health is fine. But you look like you're better. Memory plays tricks on us, never more so than when it teams up with our expectations. The past is not what happened then. It is what we are speaking about now. Shouldn't you be dead? I have surpassed expectations. I've come out on top, allied with nothing other than my own body, which has lived its life on its own premises. My body does not know which diagnoses it has been given, what kind of prognoses it has received, and this is good. Never tell me the odds, as Han Solo once said. This is me as an adult. This is me as a father. This is my son. He has my eyes, but not my diagnosis. He is also, in more than one way, a result of everything that never happened.